morning. It's Friday, the 29th day of May 2020. I'm David Ellis with you up until 2 o'clock today for this edition of Down to Brass Tacks. And Dennis Johnson is my producer and technical operator as well. Well, we've got so much to discuss. We now have what is being described as the Barbados Optional Savings Scheme. The boss move. I have no doubt, you know, we seem to love these acronyms. Bert is now the boss. In any case, we have an interesting proposal before us, because previously it was being described as forced savings, and now it has been refined to reflect an optional element in it, which means it is completely optional. So, what are your thoughts? If you're a public servant out there, I suppose you have to be careful that they don't recognize your voice, you know, because it's against the general orders to speak in public without authority, authorization. So, in those circumstances, you may want to put on your mask and distort your voice if you want to have a say on this particular matter. But however you do it, that is up to you. Now, in addition to that, you can determine whether it's good news. For most people, it is good news to have the easing of restrictions. Why do I say for most people? Because there are some places where the easing of restrictions has resulted in a return of COVID cases. I was just listening to the situation in Peru, a country that locked down early. It was locked down for about 10 weeks. And people could not get any money because they couldn't go to work. And many of the people there, I think about 70%, are in the informal sector. And as a result of that, in the rush to get people back to work, there has been a really bad situation there now, where the health system is overwhelmed. So the caution which has come from the local officials is one that you need to take very seriously, which is that even though some further restrictions have been eased, that does not give you license to go out there and do as you please. The social gatherings and the close proximity to one another is still something that we need to watch. And I certainly, first of all, would say that Barbados has done exceedingly well in trying to contain the spread of COVID. The health officials in particular have done an outstanding job. And there are some people behind the scenes, many of whom you will never know their names. Not at least not right now. They may be kept secret because they've been so involved in the fight against COVID. But in due course, one hopes that some of those people can tell their story as well. So what do you have on your mind? The situation in the United States? Well, perhaps we could talk a little bit about that as well. In my judgment, this is not about the killing of one man. This is about a system in America that has degraded people of color for a very long time. This is a system where for 8 years, people were made to feel that there was progress because there was a black man in the White House. But what we have seen is an apparent response to that, where Tea Party, Republican, and other conservative elements within the United States have redoubled their efforts to reinforce some of the worst aspects of racism and bigotry. And, you know, I've said here on this program already that one of the tragedies of our environment today is that we've lost the spokesmen. We've lost the icons of the civil rights struggle. They've been replaced by singers and sportsmen who do not take up that struggle in that way. We are in a world where what matters more than anything else is how much money you earn, how many houses you've got, how many cars you can put in your garage, and if you can get a yacht. Once you've got these things, unfortunately, it seems to be all that matters to many. The United States has gone in that direction. Are they going to pay a high price? We wait and see. We saw the Rodney King riots and what happened after that. We will have this particular wave of protests, but after this, what? And how does all of this extend to people like us in the Caribbean and in developing countries where the majority of the people are black? You really believe that if there's a particular mood in the United States, that that mood isn't going to spread to other parts of the world? When I talk about the mood, I talk about the extent to which the policies, the system itself, seems to operate against the interests of minorities, and in particular, the interests of black people. This is Down to Brass Tacks. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, sir.
Yes, good morning.
Realize I'm on the air. I want to make reference to something that was in the Daily Nation of Wednesday, the 27th of May. And I hope they don't cut me as a result of what I'm going to say. And I can try my best to do it as discreet as possible that it won't cause you and your station any problems. Now, I can read here. Marshall Morris against cut by another name. Now, you, I'm sure you saw that.
I did.
Right. What I want to say to you, right, and I refer most of what I say to Morris, when the Democratic Labour Party set about to take an 8% cut from government workers in this country, Morris was a member of Parliament and the Deputy General Secretary of Barbados Workers Union, also a representative of the working class in this country. The former General Secretary, Sir Roy Troutman, marched against the cut. But Mr. Morris, by abstention, you know, and I, at this present stage, Mr. Ellis, I am really taken aback that nobody in this country has raised it.
But I... My question is, why is this so relevant and important now, after you've heard what was said yesterday? Because yesterday...
No, sir. I heard what you said, what was said yesterday.
Yes.
I heard it. I think it is a good thing. But I am speaking in respect of what the former Deputy General Secretary Barbara's working on said in this column in the paper. And everybody in Barbados, every working class person in this country, knows full well that he did not support Mr. Troutman.
Well,
he did not support him.
The point is that Mr. Morris was talking about a pay cut, because I think that was within the context of what was being seen as this forced savings concept and stuff. What the government has said now is that it is not a pay cut, and it is optional. You know, you get part of your salary in cash, and you get part in the form of a bond or a bond savings. This person says that they are a public servant, and they resisted the thought of forced savings because they were skeptical about the security, but they're inclined to consent to this current proposal, even signing as much as 10%. So that's what's before us now.
I understand.
Whatever Mr. Morris was responding to yesterday or day before, whenever he spoke, has been overtaken by this particular proposal now.
But you're not correct, Mr. Ellis. You're not correct.
Okay.
Miss Motley made it clear before this article came in this paper that it was not a pay cut. This is what she had said before. It is
But she did not outline that in any detailed way. This is the first time you're getting that.
She should not be at liberty to come. This is political as far as I'm concerned. And now it has been brought to Barbadians and the working class in this country. Anyone could see the article from Mr. Morris. It's not a good one. And that's not what I'm dealing with. I am dealing with the fact that the former Democratic Labour Party, of which he was a member of parliament, did increase parliamentarians' salary by 10%. And a short while after, that 8% cut from government workers in this country, of which I have been a victim. You know what was taken from me? I had everything laid out, mortgage, all my spendings, and the few cents I had to take to the supermarket, 8% went out of that. 8% went out of that. And Mr. Morris was a representative of the working class in Barbados.
Okay.
And also a representative of the people of Barbados by being a parliamentarian. And he did not support Sir Roy Troutman in his effort. He abstained. Abstention tells me when you abstain. If you were against, you would vote.
So therefore, then you believe it is contradictory.
It's very contradictory. He should not come now to speak. He himself knows that. He should not come now to speak to Barbadians. And you got Barbadians now who may understand the political situation of this country, who didn't know it then. But reading it today would give someone the impression that what this present government is doing, what Ms. Motley is doing, is wrong, or she is victimizing the people, the working class in Barbados. It is not true. And I hope that other people like me would address this, Mr. Ellis.
Okay. You have done so. Thank you very much. Down to brass tacks.
Good morning, sir.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, sir. My name is Hamilton Lashley.
Yes, Mr. Lashley.
Yes, sir. I'm calling to really congratulate VOD for a most significant nostalgic program on Sundays at 1 o'clock, where the listener is taken down memory lane to listen to some of the past test matches of great importance. I thought what was most interesting was the fact that going down that memory lane, you were able to get a review of the most important cricket matches that involved the West Indies. And in this COVID-19 time, it is one of those refreshing programs for older persons like myself to tune into VOB at 1 o'clock on Sundays to hear such a program. Indeed, I believe that going forward, that more of this research should be done. And in terms of nostalgic radio, that the older persons in my age group and probably the younger ones should tune into this type of educational sporting program. I must again congratulate VOB, particularly your sporting department, because of late I've found that VOB is engaging a very educational process to ask the listeners particularly at this COVID-19 time. So, Ms. Ellis, again, to you and your radio station, I want to offer my congratulations for a wonderful program, and I'm eagerly looking forward to Sunday to listen to the exploits and adventures of Tony Kozier, a man, in my view, who is most greatly underrated in this country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and don't leave yet.
Okay, sir.
Because you give me an opportunity to ask you a couple of questions.
Okay.
And, I mean, you are a former member of parliament. You are now in retirement to a large extent, I believe.
Retirement.
So talk to me about what it has been like for you in this COVID-19 period in particular.
Well, sir, in this COVID-19 period, I use most of my time in two ways to further develop the Hamilton Ashley Foundation. We do a lot of online programs. In fact, we have a particular program for our young people, where it's over 135 of them in the foundation. We have a nice online sports program that is a cricket quiz, but we use all of the techniques of cricket on the field, which is further stimulate their interest and certainly bring them together, because you know that the young people in this time, they are very bored and they're getting tired of being at home doing nothing. So we felt that we would come up with a set of innovative programs. That is for the youngsters. But more so, I have a lot of people from across the island just calling in to me, seeking assistance, especially poorer echelons of our society, those persons living in the communities, the women and the older persons that are struggling, who are, seeking to get assistance to survive on a daily basis.
How does your organization mobilize resources to help people like that?
Well, we use what is existing already, particularly within the governmental framework. Like Mr. Corey Lane is his unit, also the Welfare Department and the Ministry of People's Empowerment and Elderly Affairs. And we use those resources. Plus, we work very close with the NGO sector, like the Salvation Army, and the churches across Barbados who are playing their role in the background. So no matter of a coordinated effort, Mr. Corey Lane in himself is, in my view, is doing a wonderful job, because he has a mammoth task ahead of him. He's inundated with numerous requests. But what I believe is needed now in Barbados is a total collective unit, bringing the Welfare Department, bringing the Ministry of Elder Affairs, also the churches, the NGOs, into a collective unit, so that we can have a serious, holistic, coordinated effort in terms of distributing those necessary assistance to the most vulnerable grouping in Barbados. But
what is the absence of that kind of coordination doing right now?
Well, because what is doing right now, you have a disseminated approach. You have, for instance, the Welfare Department doing their own form of distribution, then the ministry, but yet the unit that Corey has, that is the coordination unit, I feel, but yet there's still a bit of coordination. But at the same time, I feel that the NGO sector and the CBO sector, including the churches, all of
CBO meaning?
Community-based organization.
Okay.
Should collect, because there's a difference between NGO and CBO, should collectively now come together in a joint national effort to really seriously coordinate and further push this relief effort for the poor and most vulnerable.
But you haven't answered my question yet. I asked you to tell me what is the difficulty that is presented by the absence of this joint effort that you're talking about. You said to me, yes, different people are doing things in their own way, but with what consequences? And how would this make a difference?
Well, the consequences, there are a number of single women of large households and the elderly who are struggling, and the impact of this kind of the impact on them is great.
We accept that, but how would they, what difference would this make to distribution, to getting to those people?
Well, yes,
you're suggesting that people are falling through the cracks because of the existing system?
Because, yes, but what it would do is that once you operate from the community-based level, and you are from that level, from the bottom-up level, then those persons have a greater understanding. They know where the people is. They know who are mostly affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. And, of course, they will be best suited and best placed to not only evaluate but also to distribute the services to those persons and do the necessary assessment.
But creating a big umbrella body does not necessarily mean that you're going to be on the ground. Indeed, there are those who would say to you that it is quite possible that what you might end up doing is creating more bureaucracy.
Of course not, David. The whole idea is to be, you've heard me over the years complaining about the problems associated with the inherent bureaucracy. What it does is that it gives the community-based organization working in tandem with government that, in effect, what will happen, it lessens the bureaucracy. In fact, the community-based organizations are the ones at the bottom that are best placed to distribute these services. It would take a re-rationalization of the distribution services of government. It would be a more, as I said, it would be a joint national approach. We have to start thinking outside of the box. Over the years, what we have done, we have seriously left out the community-based organizations in the whole process. And you have credible, established community-based organizations. You have Hayesville, you have Pinehurst, you have Gordon, they're all over. It is just to involve them and help government at this particular time. Because what you need now is a far more wholesome and holistic intervention approach. It can't be about B's, it can't be about D's, it can't be about BDP, it got to be about the people, particularly the poorer people, and that effort must be coordinated as a joint national effort involving all of them, David. It will break the cycle of the inherent bureaucracy that we get so accustomed to and complain so much about and do nothing about it.
Okay. Thank you very much. That's Mr. Hamilton Lashley. You want to make one more comment, sir? I think you're going to, sorry. Well, you can talk to me again. Hello.
Good morning, Miss Ellis.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, I want to make two quick comments. One, I didn't really call about this, but having been one of those civil servants who I was in 1991, who had the pay cut, I was one of those persons who said, no, I cannot afford it. Mind you, still had the 8% cut anyway. I am heartened by the fact that this process now seems to have taken a turn where it seems voluntary. People have an option, and there are some built-in things in there, if I understand Mr. Greenwich correctly, that seem to facilitate you saying, well, I'm not able to do this month, or you can break it, you can take your money. So I think that there's some good things happening in terms of where we are in terms of that. So I think you now have people being more willing to participate. Had I had those kind of options in 1991, maybe I too myself might have said yes to the whole scenario, but that is behind me. What I really call to speak about, though, is I want to know what is being done in relation to the long lines that we see outside these buildings with people standing in the sun for hours at a time sometimes. Because when I come to Bridgetown from immigration, when BADMC was happening, Savings Plus, I go up to Republic Bank, I go through to Parish, the line is up to James Street. I drive up Belmont Road, the line from the credit union is out from the credit union, all up Belmont Road. The lines are everywhere, and we are blessed in that. I heard a gentleman raise this with you, and I'm thinking, has any consideration been given to the fact that we're so lucky that this is a dry season, we're in drought, there's no rain. What is happening or what preparation is being put in place for these persons if it is that, as we have gotten sometimes here in Barbados, we have a wet period where you can have rain sometimes for a whole week. Is any consideration being given? Because as he said, is working now. You know why? Because the rain is not falling.
But if the rain falls, we'll use umbrellas and we'll use raincoats. We have protection against rain. But let me say to you that we need to be looking at the cause. What is driving this? Now, a question was posed to the Tsar yesterday evening about the decision to do away with the alphabet system for shopping and to reopen more businesses from next week. The Tsar said that he felt confident that we wouldn't really have long lines, and he was comparing this with what had happened at the beginning of this process of shutdowns and the introduction of the alphabet system. I think what needs to be borne in mind here is that you still have a concern about physical distancing.
Exactly.
And you still have various protocols that are being introduced. And some of those protocols will slow down movement. So when you decide now that you are going to open up more of the businesses and you are going to do away with the alphabet system, I would not be surprised if we continue to see long lines.
Longer lines.
And if we don't see longer lines.
Exactly.
All right. So I think, as happened at the very beginning of this process, the government had to look at it, see how it was working. If it wasn't working right, then you tweak it. That's how they did it. And I think we all emerged at the end of the day more satisfied with how the system was working. But it is a work in progress. I think you should see it that way. And when the rainy season comes, and you know we hope it comes real soon, because out there is something else today. The Sahara dust is all over the place. You know, it fools you. It makes you believe sometimes that it's a rain cloud. It is only a dust cloud. All right, so we need it. And we will adjust. That's the wonderful thing about us as human beings. We have the capacity to adjust. And I'm sure that when you find yourself in that situation, you are going to make a judgment call as to, one, which day you're going to go out, what time of the day you are going to go out, and whether you're going to take an umbrella with you or not, you know, what shoes you're going to wear. And it all depends upon how important it is for you to get there. Sometimes when you say, well, I need to go, you know, salt and onions are the things that bring people out of their home to go to the store when they don't need anything else. If you run out of salt, you run out of onions, you know, can't cook, you know. Some people can't cook without salt meat, you know. One item can make a difference. So you say to yourself, you know, look, I can put that off until another day.
Well, in those instances where you can, but I'll put on my other hat.
Mm-hmm.
They also operate in another environment that I have no choice but to go. And I saw that, and I was quite concerned for the persons. And this is in the court system.
Mm-hmm.
I was at District A Court. Persons are outside, attorneys are outside, litigant, accused person, everybody is outside waiting. At Matthias Court, everybody is outside waiting. Because the protocol is that, no, that the directive is that only two attorneys are allowed inside at a time. It is not that the courtroom cannot accommodate more than two, because there's enough room in there to social distance and have at least six or eight attorneys inside. But we have been told two. So everybody is out in the elements, because there's no waiting area. These courts were never designated in any way to have a suitable waiting area for persons. And those persons have no choice but to go, because you have to be there, especially if you're in the criminal court. So in those instances where you have a choice as to whether you're going to go, that is fine. But there will be those instances where you have no little choice in whether or not you go. And you can't say that the rain was falling, hence I couldn't come. So I am thinking, while it is, let's think about covering and how are we going to deal with this while the sun is shining? Because you don't want to wait until the rain starts to fall to realize, listen,
okay,
something needs to be put in place. That's all I'm saying.
All right, ma'am.
Thought is being given to that.
Thank you very much. When it comes to the kind of responses that I'm seeing here online, there seems to be some measure of support for this optional program which the government has put before the public of Barbados. And I suppose I can. It's better for me to share some of the comments which have been made with you. This person says that originally they. Well, one person says that this optional approach is welcome. He said, I support the refined version of the public sector salary proposal. What is upsetting, though, is that public officers are continually asked to bear burdens of structural adjustment. Let's remember that for 10 years, public officers didn't have increases and were subjected to a myriad of direct and indirect taxes. Faced with that background, it is a tough ask to ask them to give up any part of their salaries under any circumstance. The tourism sector closed for the foreseeable future. Some public officers are carrying those displaced family members financially. So this optional approach is welcome. Another person says, it sounds as if the government may not achieve the amount of money it needs. I may have to come back to the drawing board, that is, in short order. Now, last evening, one of the questions posed had to do with this concern about the private sector versus the public sector. And I think it was Dr. Greenwich who made the observation that the government doesn't pay the private sector, it pays the public sector. And it has some measure of influence over what can happen there. The whole idea ultimately is to drive public spending on projects that will effectively create a stimulus program. That is like you're taking from one group to create that stimulus program and to have an incentive inside there at 5% interest over the 18-month period. Okay? And if you can arrive at what is seen as a win-win, because if the public servant can feel that it is attractive enough to go for the bonds, that they can feel confident enough to go for the bonds. Because, you know, the bonds weren't touched, but there were other elements of the program, the savings, the government paper that had been touched by the government. Ultimately, it is whether you have enough confidence that going forward, the bonds will remain untouched by any austerity program. The government assures us that it is now on the right track. And you will have to determine whether you're satisfied with that. As it relates to the other question of possibly having to come back for more, I think that is driven to a large extent by the extent to which people believe that it is attractive. Now, you got two elements to this. It is, so you may have a public servant who may take the bonds and after a while may say, listen, I don't want these anymore, I want cash. So they can sell the bonds to private people who may look at it and say, well, you know, in this climate, I get 1% or just over 1% from the commercial banks. Well, what can I do with this money? You know, I've always told you, though, that there's a dilemma that a country faces. In life, you get with one hand and you lose with the other. High interest on bonds in Barbados are perceived to have encouraged people to be risk averse. If you don't get 5%, 6% on your bond, and you're only getting 1% in the bank, what are you going to do? You can try to look for ways to make that money work. But if you can get the 5%, you say you're comfortable. You put your money there and you sit down and wait. So you don't really have to take risks or anything like that. So that is another dimension to the offer that's on the table. You should know that the income tax filing and payment deadline has been extended. It is now extended until June 30th, 2020. And that is the information that I've had from the Barbados Revenue Authority. I want you all to help me answer this particular question. I don't have the answer to it. This person says that their neighbor has been working from home. She does data entry. She fell while going to the bathroom. The question is, was she injured on the job? Some people, she says, are saying that she was injured on the job because she was working from home. Of course, I assume much will depend upon the hours of work when she was supposed to be working from home, you know, and then there are all sorts of other questions that may arise as to what caused her to fall and all of that. But you answer the question for me. If you fall ill or get an injury, it is better to put it that way. If you get an injury while working from home, can it be said that you were injured on the job, while on the job? Down to brass tacks. Hello?
Hi, David.
Yes, hi. Good morning. Good morning.
The only thing I would say to that question is the location of the, at the time the employment is being carried out. She might still be an employee by virtue of the continuity of employment, but I would like to think if you get employed outside of the premises of a company, you know, how can you say that the company is at fault because of unsafe conditions? But I wanted to speak this morning, David, three issues, and I'll go through them quickly. One, the question of the Republic Bank. We saw in the news someone came into the bank last week who was positive, and as a result of that, they've been doing testing. They did some that came back negative, and they're doing some today with the other members of staff. Here is another example, and I really have to say that I am totally disappointed now with the reporters and these press conferences. At first, the first two or three press conferences, I felt they handled themselves okay, but it is particularly sickening what goes on there. Nobody asked that question. Because we haven't had a positive test prior to last week, so what we want to know who it is. Was it someone who is not identified? And how can the person be positive? You know, just some basic questions. Is it that the person was tested positive and be allowed to be out? Or was it somebody who was allowed to be out and not in isolation, et cetera, et cetera? So just some questions. I just felt you needed some clarity on that. The second question concerns, and then I'm just going to talk about this new program, this new offer from the government. The second question involves the media, and I'm noticing in Barbados today that the leader of the opposition PDP party, Bishop Joseph Attlee, and the president of the DLP, Verla de Pisa, are saying that they fear that if blatant biases are left unchecked, the CBC could well be reduced to propaganda machine. And before Bishop Attlee was saying, he knows in the past CBC has been accused of, you know, governing when you would within whichever political party is in, there seems to be a bias towards that operating, you know, more favorably to the government in power, but he's seeing it now in starker terms. And the thing that he's complaining about is last week Sunday's People Business, where you were analyzing and assessing and critiquing the government's 2 years in power, and you bring on the general secretary of the party that is in power, you bring on the finance minister who's responsible for all the policies that you've been putting in place, and you bring on someone who is an overseas diplomat who was a former BLP parliamentarian and a minister, and a political scientist who, you know, in the past, well, some people might not see that person as neutral. And I am saying that I tie this to what Dr. Rowley in today's Newsday has been saying. He is pretty upset about what is going on with the media. He said fueling their own agenda and misrepresenting, example, the government handling of the Venezuela vice president. But the most important point here. He says, in Trinidad and Tobago, let me say this here now, we do not have independent media houses in TNT. What we have are media houses with interest to protect. And I have been concerned because CBC, yes, have always promoted government's agenda, whichever party's in power. But now to me, and I agree, Bishop Attlee, it is stark. And you get very little opposition view.
But CBC does not constitute the media of Barbados.
No, so I'm going to join with that now and say, so that's CBC. And in a situation, you know, I keep coming back to this from the day after the government came into power with a 30-0 majority. The media's role is critical as the watchdog and providing information to the public, etc. So you have the government station. But then I'm saying that when you look at the private media, because he talk about One Caribbean, I know One Caribbean owns The Nation and VOB, and their role in it in Trinidad. But I'm saying when you look at the private media, if I make a comparison, let me go to The Nation first. If I make a comparison on what I see on The Nation front pages, page one, and I compare to what I saw under the last government, the last DLP government, and you could see major issues and sometimes issues that you didn't think were major.
That's taking that kind of approach. I mean, is a very tedious one because it will require a fair amount of research, and there's a lot of subjectivity on that. I really don't think that you can. Everything depends upon the time. There was a time under the Democratic Labour Party administration when it did not appear as though there was this strong, what you might call as anti-government, but what others may see as a fiercely independent posture. It all depends upon who's watching it at a given point in time.
But you all
did not always go through that. It's the same thing. I mean, we sit down here and we go through it too. I watch trends and I say to you that as a person trying to take a very independent and middle of the road line in this radio station, that, you know, you have to work hard to make sure that that is maintained, because the political operatives do everything in their power to try to influence things even within the private sector.
Okay.
And therefore, when you look at Barbados right now, going across the landscape, you look at, take CBC out of it because we know their general tendency. But you cannot really say that right across the board, there is no attempt to identify what are seen as the weaknesses of this administration. Any of the issues that you can identify as genuine issues in this country between May 2018 and now, I would submit to you that the bulk of those issues, 99% of them, were portrayed in the private media.
All right, Mr. Ellis, I didn't get to finish my second point. So I'm just saying, I listened to your point. You interjected in the middle of what I was saying, but I take your position, you have your position. All I'm saying is, if you look at The Nation newspaper and their coverage and the issues that are covered as opposed to the last administration, it is clear that positive coverage is given on the front page solely to the government, and no negative coverage in any major way is done and in The Nation. And in particular, columnists, there is no different view. You look at the persons who are writing columns, and you cannot seem to get persons who will have an opposition point of view, not necessarily a opposition spokesperson, but you could do that. They used to have the DLP and BLP column, but even so, there is the columns that I don't read them except Albert Bramford, and you get him once every 6 weeks. Now, when it concerns VOB, when I look in the call-in program segment, persons will probably raise an issue. Some persons say they get more difficulty than other persons to raise the issues. I have heard the comment over and over, and I tend to think they're right in some respect. You have persons on the Statsman and the others, when they call, they just talk and talk, and they're allowed no interjection, etc. But other persons, when they come in with their point, persons interject, butt in, you know, disrupt, etc. But let's even forget the call-in program where you could raise an issue like I'm raising now. But I look at the Sunday programs, the Sunday Brass Tack programs, and these were the programs in the last administration that featured heavily on government policies, actions, scandals, whatever it is, you name it, or perceive things that were going on, carried in a big way. I am saying now we have fluff. We have persons discussing, well, for example, last Sunday, even the 24th, when you should have been looking, doing a critique of the government 2 years policy, we had mental health discussion, which was the second program. Persons will discuss youth persons. I mean, I can't even go through. I would have to go back the podcast and look at the things discussed on Sunday. Completely different from what happens in the past, because you have a deputy commissioner of police. A issue arose out of that. Caswell Franklin is there. Nothing to discuss it. You have the question of this force saving. No program to discuss it. So VOB also is part of that. And that is where I'm saying...
I really don't... You see, I run a situation here where you have brass tacks Monday to Friday. That's 5 days. You've taken those 5 days out of this discussion altogether and focused on a Sunday program. All right? Within these Monday to Friday programs, these issues are discussed here by the people of this country.
But are there representatives talking?
Listen,
Caswell Franklin?
I want to say to you that the most important people who speak on brass tacks are average people. The representatives have their places, like they go into the Senate and they talk, all right? They can go on CBC, many of them, and they can go and talk. But the people of this country need to be given the opportunity to speak. People like you take that opportunity and talk your talk. I mean, I will say to you, we are not perfect. It is quite possible that on the days that you mentioned, we could have mastered a program that looks specifically at X or specifically at Y. But, you know, for us, taking time in laziness, we don't get one time, you will get another. I remember the days when we used to mount these programs under the Democratic Labour Party. And when we invited them, nobody came. All right? Because we were considered persona non grata.
You could make that argument against them, and then they will have to come and defend why.
I'm not making the argument against them. I am just saying to you that as much as you are talking about these programs that were mounted, they were mounted, and there was an attempt to be fair to all concerned. And all I will say to you is this. I mean, we have to go with what the people are interested in. That's what we got to do. And
so there's no interest in
yeah, but as I said to you, look, you know how many things I want to do, but I got to determine when I'm going to do them, because I didn't do them last week. It doesn't mean anything happened.
All right. I'll move off of that.
But I'll say to you, in general terms, therefore, you can't come to me and say that there's this systematic attempt to make the government look good and only to make the government look good. We have been able to identify the strengths, and we've been able to identify the weaknesses. And I give the assurance that for the time that I remain in the position that I occupy, I am going to ensure that as best as I can, I stay faithful to what we've been committed to for so many years.
Okay.
You can't allow at this stage of the game to let this thing slip away, because a lot rides on it. There are so many people in this country. They may not agree with positions from time to time, but at least they respect the fact that we give you the opportunity to hear as many sides of any story.
All right. I want to move on.
And sometimes they resent the fact that we give you so much time too.
And then cut me off in the middle of talking. But
yeah.
I
you need a radio station for yourself. I think you need to go online.
I'll move on to my third point. Before I do that, I'll offer congratulations to VOB, though. Let me congratulate Miss Lisa Gale, Miss Joanne Haig, Mr. Corey Lane, Mr. Peter Wickham, and finally now Mr. Sanka Price, who have all seemingly been rewarded in some way or another with positions with this new government. So I want to congratulate them on the good work.
Let me just comment on that. I remember 2008. I remember that we recruited a number of people as moderators. And when the government changed in 2008,
only one.
One was made a minister.
Uh-huh.
And some of the others that were associated with us were placed on boards.
I don't know.
I defended the position then by saying, and the BLP cussed me. I took a lot of heat for it, you know, because it suggested that I knew that these Dems, as they called them, were out there supporting the Democratic Labour Party, and yet we were complicit in the political play by having them on the air. I said
but
then,
you know, that's not true.
I'm very glad you know that.
You know,
Max. I'm glad. Let me make the point.
A moderator before, so you can't.
Yeah, maybe before, yes, but how long before and all that? They come to me with.
Still here on the program?
But hold on a minute. Yeah. Just hold on, huh? Just hold on.
Okay. Sure.
So my defense of the thing was, look, we go and look for people, the best people that we could find as moderators. But you know what happens? After they have established themselves in the public domain using this forum, politicians look at them as people that they can use. And especially the people who are in power, who have the resources and the positions that they can give them, they come after them. I would
but
not
David,
be surprised. Let me finish.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised if a similar thing happens now. All right? And it isn't because we line up with no political party. It is simply that we have put people before the public, and the political party in power wants to come after them. Though I know have to perhaps I may have to soon look for a whole slew of new moderators.
But David, they're still there. They're working as advisors. They're working on board. They're working as communication specialists. They're doing things for the government, and they're still there.
Well, the fact of the matter is, you just put...
They took them and they plucked them out. And you were talking about the last set of persons. How many persons that were moderators went on board? The only person you all...
Listen, I've had a former...
Please.
I don't want to get any more specific than that. Just to say to you that we have had that kind of situation before. I think it is one of the challenges of running a project such as this, because you know you're trying your best to look for people who can bring something to the program. Most of all, I like to think that, you know, my favorite word is to have a balanced approach to these things.
But you don't have it now.
Well, but you know what? Listen to me. Let me say something. And if I don't have it now, it is something that we will. It's a work in progress.
Okay. I give you that. Let me just make my last one quickly on this whole question, David. Maybe you can help me. I listened to the Prime Minister's discussion on the now. It moved from 4-7 to what was it called? Meet and turn to now voluntary. And I agree that at least I believe the voluntary system is the better system. But you know something, David? These are the questions I'm going to leave with you. We only discovered in the discussion in that press conference that it is $100 million they were looking to fill.
120.
Yeah. 120? I thought I saw 100 million. Okay, 120 million. Do you know those journalists didn't ask? And I'm asking myself, if it's only 100 million and you went straight to the public servants, the question still remains, which I discussed with you and others discussed, what about the fees of the consultants and the number of ministers? What savings you can get there? Because I spoke to Dennis Johnson this week and I pointed out in the 9th of January 2019, Trinidad Guardian newspaper, Dr. Rowley said that he decided to reduce his cabinet from 33 to 23. He removed 10 ministers, and there was a savings of $50 million for the year, each year, because of that. Minister salary is not the only saving you will get. Permanent secretary, ancillary staff, all the other things that go in forming a complete new ministry, those are savings that will add up. I am saying you have to show, because if you're saying we're all in this together, you have to show that you are leading
okay.
by example.
All right. Well, let's move on. We've had a fair amount of time.